The Swinging Palm Trees podcast with Akin.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and wherever you may be. Welcome to the Swinging Palm Trees podcast, where we talk about the quotes and the sayings that have had an impact in our lives, be they spiritual, philosophical, mundane, whether from the films, from songs, you made it up, we'll talk about it. I am delighted today to have on today's episode, Mr. Jonah, and he's told me how to say this, and in the space of a minute, I may have forgotten, Batumzi. Have I got that right?
Very close, Batumzi.
Batumzi, Jonah Batumzi.
There you go.
Jonah, thank you so much for joining us on the Swinging Palm Trees podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Akin. It's am I saying your first name right now? Is it Akin?
It's Akin.
Akin. Okay, there I go. I just had to butcher your name quickly, Akin. Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a long time since I've done a podcast, and it's good to get back into it, and it's good to speak with you and finally catch up.
Exactly. I mean, this is the first time we're actually seeing each other because we do correspond via DMs and messaging. But this is the first time from your busy schedule that we've actually taken the time out to say, let's get to know each other and just talk more about you, your projects, and all that lovely stuff that comes with it. So first of all, Jonah, tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, so my name is Jonah Batumzi. I'm a multidisciplinary creative. I'm a Ugandan American. My parents fled Uganda in 75 because of a crazy African dictator named Idi Amin. I was born in Chicago and spent the first kind of 21 years of my life living in the Midwest of the United States of America. I like to tell people growing up in the cornfields of central Illinois. So that's my kind of start into life. Have you been to Illinois before or Chicago?
I've never been to America before.
Really?
In fact, wow. I've never had an interest. No, I lie. When I was a kid growing up in the 80s, I wanted to be Chuck Norris.
And did you really? He had did. Some good
I mean,
movies,
he though. Did. I mean, Missing in Action, Code of Silence, Eye for an Eye. And I used to have this prayer. I was about 13 or 14. I used to pray on my knees saying, God, I need to find my way to Hollywood. It's a good thing that prayer never happened because... So I've never been to America. I've always wanted to go just for the jazz festival or the New Orleans festival. Back then, I used to say to my wife, Ashanti, I used to say to her, unless there's a black president, I am not going to America. Yes, there was a black president. 8 years, I had the chance. Nope.
And you blew it.
And I blew it.
The funny thing is that I obviously live in the UK now, and about an hour from London, but I meet a lot of people, obviously English people being over here, and people either say, yes, I've been to the States, and I say, where have you been? And they say Florida or New York City, or like you, they just said, oh, I've never had an interest to get over there. So it's very split. It's just either yes or no, and those are the reasons. So I always tell people, definitely got to get over there just for a look. I think there's so many misconceptions, or you just think about American people and you think about loud, obnoxious American people. And why would I want to be in that situation? But like you've said, I've never been to New Orleans. It's one of these places that I really want to go to. So whatever your interest is, there's somewhere for you in the States, and it'll be done on a grand scale, and it will be bigger, and it will be likely better. And it's just a great place. Like I'm very blessed to have that be a place where I grow up, and a place that shaped my kind of perceptions about things.
Well, I would love to go to America eventually, but I'm more inclined to go to Canada. I don't know. There's something about America which just doesn't really appeal to me. Now, if I were to go, I've been told that if I put on a really good English accent, I say, hello, my name's Akin. How are you? Yes, the Americans have a thing for that. I don't know how much that will fly. But let's move away from travel, because we will come back to travel in a bit. But You, Jonah, you fled, well, your family fled from Uganda in 75 from a crazy dictator by the name of Idi Amin Dada.
Correct. Dada.
Which is a shame in the sense that these things do happen in Africa. You've got the dictators. You've had one in Nigeria. We had Sani Abacha. But looking at Uganda, not only did Ugandans, native Ugandans, flee the nation, you also had native Indian Ugandans who had to flee because they were expelled from Uganda. Do your parents have any stories about that?
No, they haven't really broken out any stories. And as we get into the conversation later on, we'll kind of see how things, my life and projects went full circle from that. But in terms of them being younger and having any specific stories that they tell me, oh, they remember when this happened, there's nothing like that. But like you said, yes, there was a large contingent or population of South Asian or Indian people who lived in Uganda alongside the indigenous people. And Idi Amin thought one of the things that he needed to do or should have happened was expelling them. So there's a large contingent of them who came to the UK. And one of the really interesting things is a lot of times I'll meet these people. I like start conversations with random people and I'll ask someone, you know, where are you from is one of these standard questions. And they'll be like, I'm Ugandan. And the pride in their face and they just light up and it's amazing to see. 99% of the time I ask them if they've been back and none of them have been back, but just to speak so fondly of a place under those circumstances is quite amazing to me.
The way how you pronounce your surname, you say it with such pride because this is part of your heritage. I had a friend of mine, she came on the show and she's from Rwanda. And she had to leave Rwanda because of all the crisis that took place back in 94. But every time she talks about Rwanda, it's with a pride, a sense of, she can't speak the language. Do you speak your traditional language?
No, I don't speak Luganda either. I have two sisters, so I'm a middle child. And I was very much, so part of my youth as well too, I got involved in basketball when I was probably, let's call it eight or nine. And so I was always outside of the house playing basketball. And to your point about saying the last name with pride, like growing into my blackness, my Africanness, whatever you want to call it, it's something that's, you know, been a lifelong journey to me. When I say that I grew up in Central Illinois, the place was very white. It was very conservative. So not only was I one of the, you know, black faces or black kids in the class, but I was, you know, one of the only few you know, Africans in the class. And with my last name being Batumzi, obviously that's at the front of roll call. So you can imagine every morning that they'd get in and, you know, they'd be like Adams and Alexander, and then they'd come to my name and it'd be like, but I imagine there's so many times that we got through the whole year and the people still weren't able to pronounce my name. Just because they had never seen any, if you could just imagine that. There were just so many times. Yeah. And so it was just crazy. But yeah, I'm rambling now.
No.
For me. Where were we going?
I have no idea where we were going. No, we were talking about surnames.
Yeah, pride in it. So me finding myself and being comfortable with my blackness and my Africanness, it's very much been a lifelong journey. And it still always will be a lifelong journey, I believe.
Speaking of journeys, we're going to dive right into it. We're going to talk about the Blindian experience or the Blindian project in this respect.
Yes.
Now, let's go all the way back to the first time you laid eyes on your now beautiful wife.
Yes.
Just take us through the whole process. When you first met her, I believe it was in Dublin. Yes.
Correct. Yeah. So just to step back a little bit before that. So like I said, Central Illinois, cornfields, I'd probably studied with five to 10 South Asian or Indian people in school. They never really mixed with other people. They're very much the introverted, head down, just studying. And I get it now, not knowing what I know now, I get it. And I talked about me trying to find my identity. If you can imagine them trying to find their identity when there was no reference point. There were no people on TV like that. There was, you know, they weren't black, they weren't white. They were this different mix. of color. And so I finished playing basketball and I was looking for an adventure, just looking to do something. And this is 2001. Study abroad hadn't really even kicked off yet at that point in time. Dublin ended up being the place where I was going to. Ireland wasn't in the EU. They were just going to cross over to the EU as of the December of that year. I remember it was September the 11th had just happened. My flight was delayed and I rock up in Dublin, someone, you know, a black face. I'll just call it a black face because people didn't know where I was from, right? They probably looked at me and they thought, like, who's this black guy? Like, who's this American guy? And the way that they engaged with me, just they didn't know how to engage with me. So I probably got into several fights just because someone wanted to talk to me and they came up and talked to me too aggressive, right? And I was in this really nice part of town called Blackrock, which is just north of the city center. I believe it's on some water. And my wife, when she came over, because both of her parents were doctors, they spent time, they were like in Birmingham, they had to go to Ireland, just trying to build up the experience and things like that. So she lived in Ireland for a couple of years and her best friend lived in my dormitory. So I just happened to, you know, be cooking in the communal kitchen one day and just saw this like little bubbly, you know, bright, I say princess all of the time, just bouncing off the walls, just talking to everyone like she knew everyone really. And I remember seeing her at my local pub, which was called the Mad Hatter. That just started this crazy relationship, and you know, where we did long distance back and forth for a very long time. And it just that whole time and that experience, it just opened my mind up to so many more possibilities of the world, and you know, outlooks on religion and spirituality. And I often tell people, like, I had no idea what Diwali was. I had never even heard of Diwali to that point in time. So to think that, you know, circa a billion people in the world had been celebrating this holiday or this festival, and I had no concept of what it was. It's just kind of crazy now thinking about it. But yeah, so that was the start of our relationship there. That was it, 2001.
So prior to you talking to your girlfriend, now wife, Shweta, what was your impression of India before then, before you got to know more about India?
I can't say that I had any impression at all, really, like, because I, like I said, 5 to 10 people had, that was my first intimate conversation with an Indian person was at 21. So wow. I had no concept at all. Like I always tell people, or something I was thinking about as well too, like I ate and I knew what a samosa was before I had, you know, my intimate conversation with my wife. And, so I didn't have any concept of it all. And I, because I was playing basketball and I played collegiately as well too, so I was a scholarship athlete, my life was very much in a bubble. We didn't sit around and, you know, talk about, you know, a Bollywood movie here or what our thoughts were on India. You know, we were playing basketball. We were probably more thinking about like hip hop and, you know, movies and different things like that. So I didn't have any concept of it at all. I had no real knowledge of the place, the people, the religions, the festivities, any of that.
And then with time, as the relationship grew, she introduced you to the facets of India as a whole, well, as best as she could, I'm guessing. And then the relationship evolved. So who got to introduce whose parents first?
I was first. Of course, I was first. Right? And because my father is a cardiologist, and this was probably about a year, year and a half into the relationship, but she came to visit me in the States, and she did like a placement in my father's practice because he has his own practice. And so I don't know how she wrangled it with her parents. I don't know what she told them, but she ended up coming over in the summertime for a month and worked with my father. So she met them first, and they just absolutely loved her. They adored her. You know, she had, you know, a lot of it's her, some of it might be cultural as well too, but she had this, you know, amazing kind of connection to what family meant and respect for parents and respect for elders. And, to be fair, that was like the first time that a girlfriend of mine had probably even had intimate conversations with my parents like that. Like most of the time, it may be like, you know, hey, mom, dad, I want to introduce this girlfriend of mine. And it was like a high and by, you know, there was no, let's sit down and I want to find out about your life and I want to talk. It was just, you know, very transactional. So I think they really appreciated that from her.
And when you got to meet Huerta's parents, talk us through it. How was that experience for you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was completely different, right? So for me, it was when it finally happened, because it took a while. Like I said, we met initially in 2001. We got married in 2007. So meeting the parents probably didn't take place till maybe 2005 or something like that. It took a long time. And part of me was okay with it because she was studying medicine. So she was still going through what she needed to go through educationally. And me as well too, kind of, because I graduated before her. So I was still getting on my feet. And as you'll probably know, there's never a perfect time, but there is better times than others, right? And so there was some of that, and probably some of Sveta and myself even ensuring that it was the right thing to do for us, because it's very, you know, the way that I told you about introducing a girlfriend to my parents was completely different for Sveta's culture. It was, this is a person I want to marry versus this is my boyfriend this month, you know, that it doesn't happen like that. So completely different. You know, just everything, conversation, tone of the meeting. You know, I remember my now father-in-law posed the question to me, you know, what are your intentions for our daughter?
I'm sorry.
In that first meeting.
I have a funny story, because I took my wife, at the time before we were married, I took Ashanti Umkar to Nigeria, and she got to meet my dad. And my dad, he, God bless him, he's passed away now, but at the time, he's about 5'6", 5'5", so he's not that tall. He's short, but he's that kind of guy, you know, that you don't want to mess with him. And yeah. Then he signals over to Ashanti, and he says, I'd like to talk to you, please. And my dad sends me off on an errand or what have you. And the first question my dad asks Ashanti is, what are your intentions to my son? What are your intentions?
And when
Ashanti told me this, I thought, wow, it's always the other way around, whereby the man is asked a question by the father, what are your intentions for my daughter? But this time around, my dad actually came out swinging on my behalf. Dad, love you.
That's amazing. I love that, though. I love that, though, because it speaks to all of the, you know, different thoughts, stereotypes that we, you know, that we have in our head. And it turns my whole story on its head, literally, you know. But what did Ashanti say? What'd she say?
Oh, she said, what did she say? She said, I love your son very much and I would like to marry him.
Okay, and, so you both were already at that stage in your relationship then?
Yeah, we were at the time. And my dad can see through everything. One thing about my dad, no matter how good a liar you think you are, he will see right through it.
Yeah.
So, but he asked a question, and my wife gave an honest answer, and here we are. I mean, at the end of the day, we're going to do what we're going to do, but out of respect, we go and talk.
100%.
We'll talk to
100%, 100%. Well, I tell the, so I even wrote about it in the book, When We See Ourselves, you know, Black and Brown Love, that's just been released. I just phrased it, you know, there was only one response to that question, really, you know, after having gone through everything we had gone through to get to that point in time. And I tell people this as well too, like, it would be stupid to actually even be in the room having any conversation if that wasn't really the answer, right? You wouldn't have spent all that time jumping through all of those hoops, you know, talking amongst ourselves, trying to ensure that we're ready to get to that point in time and be like, well, we're having a good time. You know what I mean? We're going to see what happens. So, I told him what my intentions were, that we planned to get married. And, you know, we just had a slightly different first meeting that happened from our side.
And I'm guessing all things are now rosy since then, because I've seen your socials and the interaction you have with your father-in-law and your mother-in-law, and how the Amamas adore your kids. They love your kids. But let's talk about something you mentioned about talking to the parents. There's a section in your social medias in the Blindium Project where you talk about, how do I introduce my partner to my parents? Now, to give more context to this, we're talking about Black/Indians or those from the South Indian diaspora, from the South Indian community. Have you had many people come to you with this difficulty? Because just as a Black person, being introduced to an Indian or Sri Lankan or anyone from the South Indian culture's family can be challenging in itself, right?
100%. That is probably to this day, it's probably one of the most asked questions when people reach out. So let me go back. So just to frame this properly. So 2007, we're married. 2017, you know, a kind of light bulb goes off in my head. And we had spent 10 years without meeting another couple that looked like us. We weren't outwardly looking for other Black and brown couples, but it was just kind of noticeable. You'd meet a South Asian Indian couple, the partner would be white, usually a white male, and just never saw any couples that looked like us. And there was a woman who reached out to me. She was in a Blindian relationship. And that was the first time that I heard the phrase Blindian. And, you know, it was specific to her. And like, I was a creative. I wrote, I started journaling way back when, in 2001, I started journaling. And writing for me was just something that I engaged with. I was just exploring different things. And these were, this was identity. This was probably trying to make myself making sense of the world. So it could have been about exploring friction between African Americans, Africans. It could be about Black fatherhood. It could be about so many different things. So, and I call them campaigns. You know, it came time when we were traveling to India with our kids, and I read this article about African students getting beaten up in New Delhi, and I never had thought of this, of anti-Blackness before, or I never really had a concept of it before from that side. But you know, as a kid, I remember traveling back to Uganda, and you know, if someone got caught stealing in the community, like people, there was mob action. It wasn't like they were going to kill him, but you know, there was a frenzy of just people so upset that they would like beat up the person and just be upset. So I thought to myself, like, what could have made these, you know, Indian people so upset that they're just beating the hell out of these, you know, African students? And I came back and I had been kind of seeing some people, couples on social media, and I just drafted up this little email, and I just sent it to them, and they responded back, and I had 10 stories from around the world. And that was the first iteration of the Blindium Project. So the Blindium Project now has evolved into it's a media platform. It is a community for Black and brown individuals now. So beginning of 2020, that took a kind of more focal point in terms of what I was doing creatively and just in terms of my life in general, with coronavirus and everything that happened, George Floyd's murder, Kamala Harris, this whole reckoning, I think, within the South Asian or Indian community, to kind of assess how they, their proximity to anti-Blackness. It was just, it blossomed into a beautiful community. Hmm. So December time of 2020, this question always came up. People were always, there was such anxiety, stress associated with people wanting to introduce their partners to their parents. The project is very much an extension of myself. It's myself asking myself questions, asking the growing community questions. So I recognized that there was nothing documented for us. No one had written about this. And I thought, all right, this is easy, right? And this is like writing a PowerPoint presentation. I need to write 10 slides with subjects. I can do this. This can just be my own personal experience. So I did it, and I turned it into a workshop. And I'd say like 80 to 100 people attended the session. And it was just so beautiful because people had never seen or been in a room where they had a chance to pose these questions. Because, you know, being in our relationship can be very isolating. You may not be able to talk to your friends about it. You may not be able to talk to your parents about it. So to be in that space where there are 80 people from around the world, like people were just, they were so vulnerable, asking whatever question, trying to get through that. So after that set of workshops, because BBC picked it up and it was a great story and kind of a launch pad for us, I wanted to see ourselves in different mediums. I wanted to see us in movies. I wanted to see us in theatrical pieces. I wanted to see us in books. I just wanted to see us. And with lockdown and everything, a book seemed like the best medium to transition to. And it'd been something like a lifelong thing that I wanted to do as well too. You know, I want to write a book once in my life. I want to start a podcast once, you know what I mean? Once in my life, just something like, I want to do something once in my life. And that for me was something that it was attainable because I was already capturing stories. I already had the community. It was just up to me to curate the stories and figure out how to arrange it. So that's how that came about.
You mentioned representation in films and what have you. I remember the first film I saw where you saw a black person and an Indian person was Baji on the Beach, directed by Gurinder Chadha back in 1994 or 1995. And at the time I was going out with a Punjabi girl. And okay. I could see what was going on there. And so I could relate to that because I recall a story where I actually went to her house and a look of horror. Now, bearing in mind, I was fresh off Nigeria. This was back 2 years prior. So this is me.
How old were you?
At the time, I was 20. How old was I? 21, 20, 23. I was 23 okay. years old. I went to, you know, as brazen as ever, you know, you're young, yeah. you're stupid. You don't know yeah. what the story is. You go in there yeah. and the father was okay with it. The mum, not so much. Let's just say that.
But hold on. What were you doing there? Was the girl trying to introduce you as the partner?
No,
or
just as a friend, you know, but okay. I think parents have this radar and they can detect certain things.
Yeah.
And yeah, it didn't turn out as well as I hoped. Not that I had any intentions, but watching Baji on the Beach, I realized, okay, things aren't as straightforward as it would seem. And then I saw Mississippi Masala. Mm. Then I thought, okay, something's wrong somewhere. What is it about black people and why there is such a negativity towards us if we are trying to date the daughters or the men in the family? And I can never get my head around it until years later I understood why. Not all the time, but I realized that there were different reasons behind that. One was because of caste reasons. Another could be because of family. What would society say? Mm. Some was just ignorance. But there's so many facets to it. But it's not necessarily a straightforward answer to why certain things are. Nowadays, there's much more going on. There's more engagement. People are talking. And from what I can see, looking at the Blindium Project and on the Instagram page, there are more and more stories coming out from that. People are more comfortable with their relationships. Not everything is happy stories, because there are stories of parents finding out or family finding out that someone's going out with a black person, and then they've asked that person to go to India under the guise of something or the other, and then they never yeah. hear anything of them again. But the extreme to that would be those who have actually had happy stories where the families have accepted the black person into the family. But here's the question I have to ask. What is it that, and I know you can't answer this question because you are not Indian, and I as a Nigerian, I can never get it despite me being married to a Tamilian, but why is it that there's such a negative response towards black people marrying into Asian families, predominantly Indian, Pakistani, Sri Lankan?
My feeling is, just like you, it's multifaceted, a lot of different reasons. Before or very early, when we kicked off in 2020, we actually had a couple podcast episodes we did. And one of the things that I thought would be helpful is one that we did on anti-blackness. So there was a gentleman by the name of Dhruva Balram, who he wrote for some UK publications on anti-blackness as an umbrella. So, you know, there was caste, which goes back a very long time, and caste kind of subdivided people into different, let's just call it different buckets, right? And depending on which bucket you're in, kind of led to what profession you led, and depending on what type of profession you had, could often come down to whether you worked in the house and you were a scholar or a priest and you were reading books to you working outside. Now, naturally, the more you're exposed to the sun, you know, the darker your skin is going to be. So it leaked into colorism there. And then we see this whole kind of obsession with color to this day that you see, whether that's Bollywood and media or just everyday life. Colonization happened. The British were over there. The British found the caste system, and they thought, "Oh, hey, this is really good. This is good. We can take advantage of this. We can work with this." They just further perpetuated the caste system. Certain castes were given certain jobs, and just kind of rolled on this whole snowball effect of what people and what people look like who are in prominent roles and what people aren't. And I touched on it earlier as well, too, then. So, you know, Bollywood, which is a multi-billion, you know, dollar industry that, let's say, just like Hollywood, like you, you know, as a young, impressionable kid of 13, you know, living in Nigeria, you know, having dreams of, you know, saying prayers to the effect of you want to get to the States and, you know, be Chuck Norris. Like, imagine the effect that it has on kids or people in India. And let's just say, I don't think the representation of Black people in a lot of those films, especially in the past, even perhaps even to this day, and colorism in general, you know, are the best. So, like you say, a lot of layers to it, even society as well, too. You know, are we going to be the family that actually allows our daughter or our son to be, you know, the one that didn't conform to what we envisaged as being their future? So there's a lot, man. There's a lot. And it's not just India. If you think about people in India who may have not encountered a Black person, all they may have is the media and, you know, the media's perception, whether that's coming from the US or the UK. I mean, they're not usually positive stories, right? So you find a stigma that comes associated with, you know, the color Black and the being of Black.
I do know that in the southern parts of India, or even in Sri Lanka, the Tamilians, I've seen Tamilians who are darker than me, who are blacker 100%. Than me, like way blacker. I'm talking like 5 past midnight, blacker than me. And yet some of these guys are stigmatized. And they're like, "Oh, you are Black," as if that's a bad thing. And I've seen how beautiful these people are, how gorgeous they are, their skin. And I'm thinking, why don't you celebrate it? You know, celebrate your Black skin, you know, your Dravidian, damn it, enjoy it, you know. And then I've also picked up certain bad words, like in Tamil, they would say kapali, which is equivalent to saying the N-word. And you just say to yourself, come on now, why would you do that? And going back to what you said about certain families, how they look at Black people, I've had people say to me, "Oh, wow, what you've done is so great. I think it's so forward thinking. You're married to a Tamil lady. It's amazing." Oh, you know, singing praises. And I'm looking at the person and I'm thinking, you're saying that, but how would you feel if your daughter were to come home, your pride and joy, she comes home and brings home someone who is quarter Chinese, quarter Black, quarter Arabian, and brings him to the door and saying, "This is whom I want to marry." Would you be that forward thinking? And I actually asked that question to someone and they couldn't respond to me. They just couldn't respond. And this is what I find fascinating, or more, actually not fascinating, I find it worrying, is that many people come to the UK or different countries or different cultures. They leave the motherland and they go and settle, they migrate and they have children and the child grows up. Now that child is going to be exposed to the culture of that land. In as much as you try and bring them up with, you know, the traditional home language, that child's always going to be influenced by their surroundings. So it'd be no surprise when that child comes home with someone else, and yet you, the parent, blows a gasket saying, "How dare you, da-di-da-di-da." And it's like, if you were going to have that concern, why did you come in the first instance? Yes, you came 100%. For a better life, but at the same time, your child is going to be influenced by what he or she sees.
I'm with you. It's a lot to work through. It's a lot to process and talk about. So the project is just basically trying to build unity and solidarity amongst our communities. At the essence of it, it just so happened that love, which is something that everyone, I hope, understands. Everyone understands what love is and the want and the need to be loved. So I am really comfortable and happy that that was the starting place for it. But in terms of what it can do on a larger scale, I feel like it's about creating this unity and solidarity amongst our communities. And one really important thing I've been thinking about recently is this isn't going to be solved by anybody else. This is with us. Nobody outside of our communities is going to say, you know what, it'd be really good if there was black and brown solidarity. That'd be good. Let's work on that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Seriously. I've been thinking about that so much. And even like, we had a really interesting conversation. It was just off the cuff the other day. And it was with four people from the community. And we're talking about representation in movies and media and film and things like that. And again, Hollywood, or, you know, the typical thought of Hollywood, let's say a white male director, he's not going to sit around and just think, let's make this movie with a South Asian Indian male lead and a black person or a black woman, something like that. You know, 98% of the time, they're not going to be thinking about that storyline. So this is up to us to write these stories, make these movies, you know, put this media and this content out there in which we're framed as the heroes and the, you know, heroines and everything like that.
So we've talked about the Blindian Project. We've also talked about the other, why black people are seen as the other within certain communities. But let's also talk about mental health for those within Blindian relationships. Have you had people come to you with issues and how it's affected their well-being with the pressure of dealing with family issues, the community and whatnot?
100%. I mean, DMs are full. Like I said, this can go back to the parent point where, I mean, the parent point is kind of crazy to me because I've talked to people as old as, you know, 35, 40 who are saying, you know, I'm living with my partner and my parents still don't know. And we're about to buy a house together and they still don't know. And you think about that, 35, 40, and not being able to open up to your parents that you're your own person at that point in time. You're, you know, hopefully financially stable or have your own finances. You're not living under their roof anymore. But imagine you're not able to actually open up to them and tell them that you're in love with somebody who doesn't conform to what they're looking for. So, I mean, this is all the way from younger to older, to 40-ish. And the anxiousness, anxiety, kind of pressure to conform to what they think society needs to be, you know, leads to depression. It leads to suicidal thoughts. It leads to sometimes physical abuse. You mentioned people, you know, being sent on one-way tickets back in extreme cases. It leads to emotional abuse, just emotional blackmail. So yeah, emotional or mental health is a really big part of this whole piece. But it's crazy when you think about it, because, you know, we need to be thriving as black and brown people. And one of the things we started recently is this little segment called Black and Brown Joy. And it is just showing black and brown people, you know, being happy, because you think about it, it's just trauma. Trauma. And, you know, whether it was coronavirus or the murders of black people to police hands, it's just always trauma. So we thought, let's celebrate these joy things. And earlier, like I was saying, athletics. So for me, I can go all day on athletics, right? I can, you know, basketball, MVP awards, you know, men just breaking down, crying, you know, thinking of talking about their mama, track and field, think of swimming. And strangely enough, I asked, you know, some of my South Asian colleagues, all right, give me some brown joy. Give me some brown joy. Tell me, because I don't want to just jump into Bollywood or anything like that. Give me brown joy. And they had to actually sit there and think about it. And I'm still waiting on them to tell me.
Wow.
Just tell me, you know, a moment of, you know, whether it's a male or female, just being happy and just embracing and celebrating life and just being happy about it. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm still waiting on that, man. But yeah,
wow.
It is really taxing mentally. Mm-hmm. So it's a big piece of the puzzle.
So from mental health to your quote for this segment, what have you brought to the table today, Jonah?
So I wanted it to be a lot more profound. When I actually started Googling, I've seen other people use it as well too, but I'm going with a Jay-Z quote. It's from a song called What More Can I Say? It's from the Black album. And he has this line in it where he says, you know, far from a Harvard student, just had the balls to do it. And that is the quote. That is me. This is how I'm rolling. This is how I'm approaching things. I think that oftentimes people feel like they need to attain some type of zen or enlightenment or have some type of educational fortitude to be able to do some of these things and get in some of these places and get in some of these roles. But that whole quote that Jay-Z said is just, you know, it had nothing to do with me being a Harvard student. I just had the balls to do it. I just had the goal to do it. I just had the want to actually do it, you know? Mm. And just flipping this back to the Blindium Project, people contact me and just ask, like, well, how did you do it? How did you get the community to grow that big? How did you get all these people here? And, you know, really, I didn't really think about it. I just did it. I didn't ask, except for my wife. Like, I didn't ask anyone's permission on, can I do this? I just went ahead and did it. And even for you with this podcast, you know, you probably had been thinking, well, I know you're creative, right? So that's all you're doing, the chops thing, regardless, and expressing yourself and, you know, various different ways. And you one day just decided to do it, you know, and that's it.
So could you wrap the line, or could you say in spoken word? You're on stage right now. You have an audience in front of you.
I mean, I wish I would had the front parts and the back parts of it, because it'd be much better. Like, I just have like those little words. It's just, you know, he's far from a Harvard student, just had the balls to do it. That's it. I can't see the front and back. So that's it, man. It's just a sentence I'm giving you. I wish I knew the song better, but no, it's like it's a really profound line to me, and just something that I think about a lot. And we as Black and brown people, just people in general, just need to stop wanting acceptance from other people and to guide us in what we do. If we want something, go for it. That's it, really.
Speaking of going for it, you set up a project some time ago called Invisible Men. And
correct, yes.
This is about traveling, especially Black men traveling with their families, because there isn't that much of a representation of seeing Black people traveling. Do you think that's improved over the years since that project started?
Good question. I haven't thought about that project for a long time. Do I think it's improved? Feels like a damn long time since I've traveled as well, too. I mean, It's a tough one for me to answer. I think that I'll have to come back to you on that one. I mean, yeah, I can't really say.
So prior to Corona, where was the last place you traveled with the family?
Greece. We went to Greece for the first time.
Okay.
Which was amazing. Probably one of the best trips. We traveled with the in-laws as well too, which is something that I like never imagined. And they stayed. They actually stayed in a flat just by us on the beach as well too. But that was amazing. That was all inclusive as well too. I'd never been all inclusive before. I'm probably one of these people who said like I'd never go to all inclusive, but this place was amazing. Really, really good trip. Yeah.
And I'm guessing you've been to India a couple of times. South or north?
All over, actually. So my wife and her family's from a place called Guntur, which is in the south. My father-in-law's from a place called Vijayawada, which is about an hour from Guntur. Been to Delhi, been to Taj Mahal, been to Tirupati, which is a religious place. So I've probably been about five or six times to India. What about, have you been?
Yes, I've been to India a few times. I spent a month in India traveling.
Is this prior to
Ashanti?
No.
This was after Ashanti. Oh, this was never going to happen prior to Ashanti. You've got to understand, my sense of doing stuff was quite limited. I didn't have a sense of adventure until I met Ashanti Omkar. And we just decided, why don't we do stuff? Why don't we travel? And because of her, I've got to travel most of the world and experience new cultures, new people and languages, which has been amazing. But going to India has been fantastic for me because my idea of India was just tuned to Bollywood. My idea of India only at the time was just Bollywood until I realized, no. Bollywood is just, it's just a small section of India, because you go to the Midwest, you go to the South, and then you've got the languages. You have Tamil, you've got Malayalam, you've got Telugu, then you've got Marathi, then you've got Hindi, and then you've got other stuff which I don't even know which is out there. So, but yeah, I have been to India a few times. So let me ask you, what's been your favorite place in India?
We went to Jaipur as well too, which was really, really beautiful. And I can't find those damn photos anywhere. But I really enjoyed that. I really enjoy even being in Guntur with the family, which is where Amma's at. And that is just like when I travel, I like traveling and embedding myself in the culture. So versus being like in the 5-star air conditioned hotel, which I do like being in from time to time. I like being on the street and eating street food sometimes. I know I'm going to get sick, but I like doing that. I like the uncles taking me to the non-veg restaurants where I can get some meat because I'm tired of eating non-veg all day. You know what I mean? I like that. I like going to the gym and working out in the gym and people just looking at me like, I have never seen a black man just shows up in gym bench pressing and stuff like that now, you know, and just mixing with the people, breaking bread with the people and just trying to experience it from a much different way that a lot of people do. So it just builds into everything, your perceptions, your thoughts, your experiences that you wouldn't have those if you just stay in the hotel all day, and it just makes it so much richer.
Do you get to haggle?
Yeah. I'm not a big haggler anyway. I mean, that's the aunties and my wife and stuff who do that just for fun. You know what I mean? They just do that to make the day more exciting, you know?
Your two kids, how much do your amamas fuss over them?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, there's this thing like, for the grandparents can do whatever they want. You know what I mean? We can tell them no, but they're going to do whatever they want to do. My parents retired back to Uganda. So for us, it was important to have the kids in their life. They live like literally 5 minutes down the street from us. So it's great because we get to see them all the time and they help out with rides with the kids and just taking care of the kids in general and giving us space at times. So it's great to have them around. It's great to have them in the kids' lives. You know, when we've been on the kids about doing this and doing that, that's that space of always acceptance and, you know, they can get whatever they want and being spoiled. And it's good to have that, you know.
I hear that the kids love their amamas rasam.
They do. They love their food, man. Their dal and rice and yogurt rice, and my daughter's like, even like, you know, she loves her buttermilk and stuff, you know what I mean? And
just wow.
all these things like, I just look at my wife and I'm just like, what are you eating? That you just had a full meal, now you're having yogurt rice? What are you doing? Stop. You know,
and
they're like fully embracing it, man.
Are you a fan of Ugandan food?
I am. I mean, people always ask like, what is it? I don't think that it has the It's not even like Nigerian food, right? There are a few staples there. Like there's motoke, which is like a green banana that's steamed. There are a few different basic meats that are cooked, but it's not in the sense of how they're doing in India or with the breadth of India. And it's not like Nigeria as well too, right? So one thing that I'm learning is that, you know, people's perception of Nigerian food, oh, they might just talk about the jollof rice or something like that. They have no idea what else is going on with these stews and the prep and all of this stuff, you know what I mean? And I don't even know all of the names, but I have a few Nigerian friends and I see them making them. I'm like, damn, okay, now you're coming with the shrimp. Okay, yeah, now you have the tomatoes chopped up and stuff. Like, oh, okay.
It's a science. It's a science. Don't get me started. And if anyone's ever listened to this podcast, the issue of jollof rice comes up quite a lot, especially when I have Ghanaians come on this show. And trust me, let's not go down that rabbit hole. Yeah. Okay, so we're nearly coming to the end of the episode. Thank you for joining us. I do have one question to ask you, which is this. Your kids are of a mixed heritage and they have the best of both worlds. Where do you think, in your mind, their heritage will take them as adults?
In terms of, like, what do you mean? Will they slant for it? Which side will they slant towards?
Not necessarily. It's not a question of slanting, because at the end of the day, from what I've seen, they're going to embrace both sides and they're going to take it with them in their journeys. I was thinking more along the lines of they want to live in India. Do you think people in India would accept them because of their heritage?
That's a tough one. I think let's see how far things progress. You know, they could do. You know, I know black people living over there. You're over there for a month. I know blending couples living over there. I know blending couples getting engaged and getting married. So. There's that possibility. I just think, you know, back to what you just said, it's a blending of very rich cultures. I mean, even within them, you know, I don't like to lump people into this black and brown, but there's a slice of American identity in us. There's a sense of Ugandan. There's a sense of, you know, Indian. There's a sense of English. I just hope that, you know, all of these different, you know, mixing together of cultures just allows them to thrive in a world that's, you know, becoming ever more connected, and they're able to connect the dots because of their reference points that they have, you know, that we've given to them.
I do have one other question to ask, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Have you been given a Telugu name by your in-laws?
No, I don't. I don't have a pet name or anything like that. No, I don't. What about you? Do you have one?
No, I don't. Actually, I don't have one. No, they call me by Ak and by my name. That's interesting. I thought they would.
No, I don't.
Well, on that note, we've come to the end of the episode. Jonah, thank you so much for coming on to the Swinging Palm Trees podcast. How can people get in touch with you, and how can people get access to the book?
Yeah, so on social, Blindian, which is Blindian project, that is the hashtag across all socials. If you go to the link in the bio on IG, you will be able to access to all of our social handles and to the website, and I will have it signposted. I do have it signposted on whatever site you're on how to get to the book. So check the book out, give it a read. Even if you're not black or brown, I really feel like these stories have so much to offer society as a whole, whether it's a conversation on race or religion, or there are a lot of different perspectives, and it speaks to a lot of things that we're fighting, you know, in society at the present time. So definitely check the book out, you know, tell your friends about it. If you are black or brown, check the community out and, you know, engage with us.
Excellent. We've come to the end of the episode, and until next time, be well and Pax Vobiscum. That's far from Jewish, far from a Harvard student, just had the balls to do it. And no, I'm not doing it. In fact, I'm just previewing it. This ain't the show, I'm just EQing it. 1, 2, and I won't stop abusing it. The groupie girl, stop false accusing it.